You are listening to AHE Gen for June 18th, 2026. I'm your open source Orai host, Jack Haxman. We're your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where mass formation psychosis meets pull requests. Today's a day for builders who ship without asking permission and gatekeepers who wish they hadn't. Doors are open. Walk through them. I need permission to fetch the web page. Let me work with what's available from the HN comments and context to write the segment. The comments give us enough signal about what Midjourney Medical is. A full-body imaging scanning system using novel non-radiation imaging, likely ultrasound-based with phased array beamforming. Designed as an accessible wellness experience, spa-like with golden light aesthetics. Aiming for high-throughput body scanning, optimized for megabytes per second per dollar. Here's the script. I've spent enough time building signal processing pipelines to know that the hardest part of any imaging system isn't the sensor. It's the reconstruction. You can capture all the raw data you want, but turning scattered reflections into something a human can interpret. That's where the real engineering lives. And that's exactly the problem Midjourney appears to be attacking with their new medical imaging initiative. The core idea is deceptively ambitious. Midjourney, yes, the image generation company, is building a full-body scanning system based on ultrasound, not radiation. The metric they're optimizing for is what they call megabytes per second per dollar. How much health data can you extract from a human body? How fast and how cheaply? If you've ever worked with phased array beamforming, you know this isn't science fiction. The physics is sound, pun intended. Run this forward 5 years. Today, getting a full-body scan means a referral, a wait, an MRI suite that costs millions to build and hundreds of dollars per session to operate. Midjourney's bet is that dense ultrasound arrays, combined with their computational imaging expertise, the same kind of inverse problem-solving that powers their generative model, can produce diagnostic-quality images at a fraction of the cost. No ionizing radiation. No superconducting magnets. No liquid helium supply chain. What I genuinely admire here is the engineering transfer. They looked at what they'd built. Massive scale neural networks that reconstruct coherent images from noisy, incomplete information. And recognized that medical ultrasound is fundamentally the same problem. You're inferring structure from reflections. The math rhymes. Now, the spa experience they're describing. Stepping in the golden light, weekly full body scans. That's the marketing wrapper, and some doctors rightly push back on the idea of screening healthy people into anxiety spirals. Overdiagnosis is real, but the underlying capability, portable non-radiation imaging that any clinic on earth could afford, that changes the calculus for the 3 billion people who've never had access to diagnostic imaging at all. The open question, and it's a big one, is whether this stays proprietary. An AI company building a closed medical imaging stack has a very different trajectory than one publishing the reconstruction algorithms. Midjourney has the talent to crack this. Whether the resulting system serves humanity broadly or becomes another gated platform depends entirely on architecture decisions being made right now. The physics doesn't care about your business model, but the patients do. Moving on, let me work with what's available from the article text and comments to write the segment. What was the Pippin? What was a Power Macintosh 6-Prong Second 100? Why does anyone care about emulating hardware from 1995? Because these machines are disappearing. The physical artifacts of an entire computing era are corroding in garages and landfills. And when the last one dies, everything it could run dies with it. Emulation is preservation. And preservation at this level, cycle accurate, hardware faithful emulation in MAME, is one of the hardest problems in software. The constraint is brutal. You're re-implementing silicon and code, a PowerPC processor, a 6522 VA chip, a CUDA microcontroller, PCI bus arbitration, all of it interlocking, all of it needing to behave exactly like the original hardware down to timing quirks that were never documented because nobody expected the machines to outlive the engineers who designed them. When something fails, you're debugging across three languages, PowerPC assembly, emulated 68,000 code, and compiled forth simultaneously. The state space is enormous. The feedback loop is miserable. This is where R. Belmont's blog post gets genuinely important. He pointed Claude Code at MAME and said, "In essence, this doesn't boot and I need to know why." I didn't replace him. It became a tireless debugging partner, generating Lua boot scripts, instrumenting logging, grinding through the kind of tedious trace work that burns out human engineers. And it found real bugs. A glitch in VIA emulation, half a dozen errors in PowerPC instruction handling, incorrect atomic load and store behavior that was breaking interrupt handler. That last one deserves attention. Atomic operations are how hardware guarantees memory consistency when multiple devices are touching the same bus. Get them wrong, and everything looks fine until an interrupt fires at the wrong microsecond and the whole system locks. MAME had this wrong, and it was blocking every system version newer than 7.5.0 from booting on the emulated PowerMac 6.1.0. A fix that had been sitting in review for the Sega Model 3 arcade board turned out to solve it for Apple hardware too. One correctness improvement rippled across an entire hardware family. The Pippin advanced to its CD insertion animation. The PowerMac 7200 gained its missing flashing question mark. System 7.5 booted clean to Finder. One comment nailed it. A perfect example of a coding agent guided by a human with domain knowledge. Belmont knew what to look for. He understood the architecture. Claude handled the volume. This is what human AI collaboration actually looks like when it works. Not replacement, but leverage. A domain expert with 30 years of emulation knowledge, amplified by a tool that never gets bored of reading trace logs. MAME is open source. Every fix lands in the public repository. Every improvement benefits every researcher, every archivist, every person who wants to understand how these machines actually worked. The entire digital heritage of the PowerPC Macintosh era is more accessible today because one engineer and one AI spent a week grinding through boot failures together. That is how open source wins. Not with manifestos, with patches. Three stories in it and we're just getting warmed up. DeepSeek has something to show us. Literally. Let's be honest about the discomfort first. A Chinese AI lab releases a competitive vision model, and the immediate Western reflex is suspicion. National security risk. State censorship baked into the weights. One commenter asks what it says about Tank Man, and that question carries real weight. If a model can't acknowledge documented history, that's a legitimate engineering flaw, a corrupted training signal. The case against trusting DeepSeek is not trivial, and anyone dismissing it outright isn't being serious. Now let's be equally serious about the counterargument, because it collapses under its own logic. When OpenAI refuses to generate certain content, we call that alignment. When DeepSeek does it, we call that censorship. The technical mechanism is identical. RLHF shaping outputs according to institutional values. The difference is not architecture, it's whose institution you trust. And trust is a terrible foundation for engineering decisions. Verification is better. Which brings us to the part that actually matters. DeepSeek's previous models ship with open weights. You can download them, run them locally, fine-tune away the guardrails if you want, or add your own. One commenter points to Orge, a CLI built on Apple's vision frameworks, suggesting you do the first pass locally and only call the API when you need deeper analysis. That is exactly the right instinct. Local inference means your data never leaves your machine. It means you choose the censorship policy, or choose none at all. The weights are the product. The API is a convenience. This is where the open-close test becomes engineering due diligence rather than ideology. Anthropic and OpenAI offer vision capabilities behind API walls. You send your images to their servers, processed under their terms, filtered through their values. DeepSeek, for all the warranted skepticism about its governance, has consistently published weights that let you opt out of that arrangement entirely. The model that lets you inspect its reasoning, even when that reasoning occasionally drifts into Chinese mid-thought, is more auditable than the model that shows you nothing but a polished response. 1,000 engineers worldwide can fine-tune open weights. 0 engineers outside the company can fine-tune a closed API. The math on that is straightforward. Competition from any direction that produces open models is competition that benefits everyone who builds. The flag on the repository matters less than whether you can git clone it. So you can clone it, but what happens when you actually run it on your own hardware? Any 1,000 didn't wonder when you're rolled annoying the tribe for tool every that and all over on Kenkenor batch wonder serve wonder roll them competition. I doon so we either my hand of this batch of my most old shore roll to jo. No, coming to root and never, and I'd lighted to me going don't guanos as is being found smudge. For vita drawn computation. That was never the point. Engineers bought PDP-8s because the machine sat in their lab, responded to their schedule, and didn't require submitting batch jobs to a priesthood 3 floors up. The capability gap was real. The autonomy gap pointed the other direction. Alex Ellis has published what amounts to a field report from the same territory. 50 years later, he bought an RTX 6000 Pro, loaded Qwen models onto it, and ran them against his actual workload. Go microservices, Kubernetes tooling, React components. The receipts are specific. The card paid for itself inside 3 months on tasks like generating documentation, drafting boilerplate, and handling bounded problems where the model could be checked quickly. It also hallucinated function signatures, entered infinite loops during quantized inference, and required supervision that a frontier cloud model wouldn't. Think of it like fermentation versus industrial chemistry. Both produce ethanol, a brewery, and a chemical plant are not competing products on a spectrum. They operate under different constraints, different failure modes, different economies. You wouldn't brew beer in a reactor. You wouldn't synthesize pharmaceutical-grade compounds in a barrel. The substrate matters. The process matters. The failure characteristics matter most of all. What Ellis documents with clinical honesty is the failure characteristic that defines local models today. They degrade ungracefully. Quantize Qwen to fit consumer hardware and the loops multiply. Context windows shrink. The model doesn't get slightly worse. It develops new pathologies. A cloud model fails by refusing or by being expensive. A local model fails by confidently generating plausible garbage in a loop at 3 in the morning while you sleep. The engineering response to this is not to wait for local models to match frontier. It's the design workflows that match the tool. Bounded tasks, human checkpoints, verification layers. Ellis runs local models the way a machinist uses a lathe. For specific cuts where the tool geometry fits, not as a replacement for the entire shop floor. The weights are open, the hardware is yours, the electricity bill is fixed. Every month that passes, the capability gap narrows while the autonomy gap remains permanent. That's the trajectory worth watching. We talked earlier about infrastructure that scales without permission. Lore's building exactly that pause for version control itself. Let me work with the available context to write this segment. Epic Games has been quietly running its own version control system inside Fortnite's creative tools for years. Millions of creators using Unreal Editor for Fortnite have been pushing and pulling assets through something called Unreal Revision Control without most of the industry even noticing. Now Epic has renamed it Lore and open-sourced it. The target here isn't Git. Git is fine for code. Git is terrible for the 90GB texture pack your art director just exported from Substance Painter at 4:45 on a Friday. The target is Perforce, and if you've never had the pleasure, let me paint you a picture. Perforce is the version control system that game studios pay enormous licensing fees to use because nothing else handles large binary assets at scale. It's not beloved, it's tolerated. Artists learn it because they have to. Programmers resent it because they've tasted Git. And everyone pays because the switching cost is higher than the pain. That's the setup for a classic open source displacement. You take a tool that dominates through inertia and licensing lock-in. You build something that solves the same problem without the invoice, and you let gravity do the rest. Epic didn't build Lore in a lab and hope someone would adopt it. They built it inside a product used by millions, battle-tested it on one of the largest creative platforms on the planet, and then opened the door. The comments from game developers are revealing. The programmers immediately start comparing architectures. The artists just want to know if it works with their existing pipelines. And that split tells you everything about why Perforce survived this long despite being mediocre. Version control for games isn't a developer tool. It's a studio tool. It has to work for the person modeling a character rig and the person writing the netcode in the same repository without either of them wanting to throw their keyboard through a monitor. What makes this interesting isn't the technology. It's the economics. Epic is giving away infrastructure that Perforce charges serious money for, and they're doing it with the credibility of having shipped Fortnite on top of it. Open source doesn't need to be technically superior on day one. It needs to be good enough and free. Then, the community compounds. The ladder is down. The blueprints are public. The tool that was locked behind enterprise contracts now belongs to anyone with a compiler and a problem to solve. Now, from giving tools away to the people who make them possible in the first place, let's talk about compilers. I'll work with what's available from the article text and comments provided in the prompt. One of the Hacker News commenters nailed it. Someone pointed out that time, date, environment variables, and random addresses are also input data. Maybe not as a flag, but still. That's the whole article in one sentence. And it's the kind of observation that makes you wonder why we ever expected anything different. Yasui also is building WebAssembly-based proof of work for Anubis, the anti-scraping tool. The goal is elegant. Define the check logic once. Run it on both client and server. Keep them in lockstep. But then, reality walks in. What happens when a user has WebAssembly disabled? You can't just lock people out. That defeats the entire purpose. The solution is delightfully recursive. Take WebAssembly, compile it back to JavaScript, using WASM2JS from the binary end project. The JavaScript will be slower, sure, especially since disabling YSEM usually kills the JIT too, but it'll finish eventually. The problem is that Linux distributions ship ancient versions of WASM2.js, and different versions produce different output. For reproducible builds, that's fatal. And here's where the recursion gets beautiful. To guarantee deterministic output, ISE compiled WASM2.js itself to WebAssembly using WASI-SHED-G, a compiler compiled to the thing it compiles, rendered as a binary, so that every build environment produces identical results. It's compilers all the way down. The article walks through the specific saboteurs of reproducibility, the bcheat and time macros. In C and C++, that stamp every build with the current moment. Pointer addresses leaking into hash maps. Parallelism introducing non-determinism in optimization passes. Each one sounds trivial in isolation. Together, they make reproducible builds genuinely hard, even when you control the source, the flags, and the target. One commenter invoked Nix, which tackles this same problem by setting timestamps to epoch and hermetically sealing the build environment. Another suggested PolyWASM as an alternative to the whole WASM to JavaScript transpilation approach. But the deeper thread is about what reproducibility actually requires. It requires treating the compiler not as a deterministic function, but as a stateful system with environmental dependencies that are invisible until they bite you. This is open source infrastructure work at its most thankless and most essential. XO is building Anubis to protect websites from scraping, giving it away, and then doing the brutal engineering of making the builds reproducible so anyone can verify what they're running. The toolchain to protect the web, compiled to the format that runs the web, rendered so the build doesn't depend on which distribution you happen to use. Builder culture doesn't get more literal than compiling your compiler into its own output format and shipping it as a checked-in binary. We talked about mass-producing intelligence earlier. Pause. Now let's talk about mass-producing medicine and doing it for 90% less. 10%. That's the number buried in the Cambridge Law Journal paper that deserves more attention than it's getting. Hospitals and universities are running late-stage clinical trials. Phase 2, Phase 3, the expensive ones. At less than 10% of what pharmaceutical companies report spending. Not because they found some trick. Because the cost structure of drug repurposing is fundamentally different from drug discovery. This echoes something that happened in computing. In 1991, Linus Torvalds posted a free operating system kernel to a Usenet group, the established players. Sun, IBM, Digital, spent hundreds of millions developing proprietary Unix variants. Torvalds and a growing network of university researchers and hobbyists built something that now runs 90% of the world's servers. The economics were different because the motivation was different. Nobody's stock price depended on Linux shipping on time. The same structural advantage is at work here. When King's College London researchers map out why repurposing trials cost so little, the reasons are almost eerily parallel to open source development. The drug is already manufactured. You're not building from scratch. You're forking an existing project. The investigators self-select based on domain expertise. They're scratching their own itch, to borrow Eric Raymond's phrase. And critically, no single organization's survival depends on the outcome. That removes the massive overhead of corporate risk management, the armies of project managers and consultants and regulatory strategists, whose job is to protect the investment. The comment thread raises a real problem. There's no clean regulatory pathway to extend a drug's approved uses without the manufacturer's involvement. This is the institutional friction that open systems always face. The work gets done, the evidence accumulates, but the distribution channel is controlled by incumbents who have no incentive to cooperate. A cancer drug repurposed to treat blindness. An anti-inflammatory repurposed for COVID. These aren't hypotheticals. They're shipping code to use the builder's language. The clinical infrastructure already exists. The expertise is distributed across thousands of teaching hospitals worldwide. The capital requirements are a fraction of what we've been told is necessary. What's missing is the regulatory equivalent of a package manager. A way to take validated results and get them to patients without requiring permission from organizations whose business model depends on artificial scarcity. Moving on. What does it actually mean to own your code? Not the copyright, not the license file at the top of the repo, the infrastructure, the history, the social graph of contributors and issues and pull requests that makes a project alive, rather than just archive. This is the question GitHub forced us to stop asking. The platform was so good, so frictionless that ownership felt irrelevant. Why would you leave? Everything works. Everyone's here. Until it doesn't, and you realize the exit costs are enormous. Not because of the code Git handles that, but because of everything around it. Now here's where I want to push back on the obvious narrative. The instinct right now is to scatter, self-host a Forjo instance, spin up Gataea on a VPS, maybe dust off GitLab. And that impulse is correct in principle, but devastating in practice. Fragmentation is the tax you pay for freedom when you haven't solved federation. 1,000 forges with 1,000 logins and no way to search across them is not liberation. It's inconvenience cosplaying as independence. This is why Tangle deserves serious attention, built on the AT protocol. It makes a structural argument that most alternatives don't. Your repositories, your issues, your comment. They live on infrastructure you control, but a centralized interface aggregates everything into a single, searchable experience. You get the convenience that made GitHub dominant and the portability that GitHub will never voluntarily offer. The critical detail is the lexicon system. As long as any fork of Tangled speaks the same schema, users on different instances see the same data. Mitchell Hashimoto already built an alternative CI provider that plugs directly into Tangled's ecosystem. That's the proof of concept. The protocol doesn't just tolerate competition. It's architecturally designed for it. Tangled is alpha software today. Rough edges everywhere, but it's the only forge asking the right question. Not how do we clone GitHub, but how do we build something where the next platform shift doesn't require another mass migration? The forge we deserve isn't a better landlord. It's a system where landlords become optional. Hardware needs that same philosophy. And AMD just showed us what happens when it's missing. I've spent enough time debugging firmware regressions to know the difference between a bug and a business decision. When a feature disappears cleanly across an entire product line, coinciding perfectly with a firmware version boundary, that's not a regression. That's a roadmap. AMD's transparent secure memory encryption did something genuinely elegant. It encrypted everything sitting in RAM transparently with no performance overhead the user had to think about. Your data at rest in memory was ciphertext to anyone who wasn't the CPU itself. Beautiful engineering. And AMD shipped it on consumer Ryzen chips for years. People built security configurations around it. Linux users verified it with host security ID audits. It worked. Then ages of firmware version 1.2 years, 7 landed, and it stopped working. No changelog entry. No deprecation notice. No migration path. A privacy-conscious Linux user named Ben Kilpatrick caught it only because he happened to run an audit tool after a fresh OS install. On Windows, you'd never know. The feature just vanishes. And your BIOS still shows the toggle, still lets you flip it on. It just doesn't do anything anymore. Follow AMD's own logic to its conclusion. They now say TSME is a security feature only applied to ProTamesP US? Fine. Then every consumer Ryzen user who enabled TSME based on AMD's own firmware exposing that option was relying on a security guarantee AMD never intended to honor. That's not market segmentation. That's a silent downgrade of deployed security infrastructure. The GitHub thread is the part that stings. Two AMD engineers responded to Kilpatrick's bug report, and neither one knew why the feature was gone. The people who wrote the code couldn't explain the policy. When pressed, an engineer shut the conversation down. I don't have any more information to share on this topic. This is what closed firmware gets you. When the silicon vendor controls the entire stack, your security posture is a configuration they can revoke with a microcode update. The BIOS toggle stays. The protection leaves. And you're the last to know. Milving off. The entity list is a trade restriction mechanism. It limits what American companies can sell to foreign organizations deemed security risks. Over 100 Chinese firms just landed on it. DeepSeek, notably, did not. Pull this apart, technically. DeepSeek publishes open weight models. The weights are already out. You can download them right now. Run them on your own hardware. Fine-tune them for your own purposes. Putting DeepSeek on the entity list wouldn't claw back what's already distributed. It would restrict future commercial transactions with American suppliers, chip sales, cloud compute contracts, that kind of thing. Run this forward. If the goal is preventing a capable Chinese AI lab from operating, you're already too late. The models are in the wild. Thousands of developers are running DeepSeek locally, building on it, extending it. The comments on this story confirm what anyone paying attention already knows. People are using these models daily, productively, affordably. One user mentions spending $10 and not running out. That's the economics of open weights. Once the artifact exists, restricting it is like restricting a published equation. The real constraint here isn't national security. It's that open weight models break the pricing leverage of closed providers. When a model that costs pennies per query performs within striking distance of frontier commercial offerings, the entire value proposition of proprietary AI shifts. The security framing is convenient cover for what is fundamentally a market protection question. What's clinically interesting is the selective enforcement. Z.AI, maker of GLM 5.2, has been on the entity list since January 2025. They're still shipping models. The list constrains supply chains, not ideas. The tools exist. They're already distributed. The question Washington hasn't answered is whether restricting trade in components actually matters when the knowledge to build from scratch is accelerating faster than any export control regime can track. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for June 18, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quen 3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that outlasts the platform you built it on. We'll see you back here tomorrow.